so he was picking up.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And thank you for coming on a beautiful afternoon to be inside a dark place like this and to share an hour with me and with the obese squirrel who may not live to be elderly. This is the second of four talks about health and wellness in the 21st century that we've involved in. The first was about global, personal, and international perspectives on what health is and health systems. And we kind of discussed that yesterday. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about faith and medicine, religion, religiosity, and medicine. A little bit about intercessory prayer from a medical point of view. Tomorrow, there'll be a session in the afternoon. In the evening, a discussion about it, sort of an introduction to medical ethics and some end-of-life issues, and kind of open up that for some discussion that should be of interest to most of us. Hold is just a great place, and it's a great place to talk about faith and medicine. Just a word about my background. I've practiced medicine at the Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis for 38 years. I've had a variety of positions. I've done pulmonary critical care through most of my career. I've been involved in medical education at the new medical school that's down there. Most recently, I've been part of the palliative care program. And for the last 20 years or so, I've been chairman of the ethics committee at Good Sam. A couple things about just an outline, what I hope to cover today. This really has been, in the past, two separate lectures, so we kind of compressed it, so I will be going relatively fast through some of these things. A little bit about the disclaimers, we'll have some definitions, so we all know what we're talking about, and the same kind of issues, and we'll kind of define religiosity and spirituality and their relationship to health status, something about intercessory prayer. And then I hope a little bit of time for discussion. And certainly, one of the nice things about Holden is that these discussions can continue on over dinner and late into the evening sometimes. I have a few disclaimers, and apologies. I am not a man of the cloth, and I'm talking about faith and religion, so that's always dangerous. I'm not supposed to talk about politics and religion. I was told that by my mother. Yesterday we talked about the politics of healthcare. Today we talked about religion and healthcare. I don't know that. I'll probably run out of Holden on a rail before this is over. But the perspective is that of a practicing physician, somebody who's been trained in science, I will try to present what is out there in the medical literature and in the medical world and how physicians generally, what evidence we have to look at the relationships of these things. If anyone is that is offensive in any way to one's own beliefs. This is what I really am. And that's what most physicians are these days, unfortunately. So the title of this was Faith and Medicine, and different ways of looking at it. Is faith and medicine? Is it faith as medicine? And that certainly is the case in some people who believe in faith healing. Faith in medicine? Do we have faith in medicine? But basically, we're talking about faith, spirituality, religion, and health and their relationship. A few definitions to get started. And again, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir about definitions here. So faith, this is from Webster's Dictionary, a confident belief that does not rest on logical proof or material evidence, or more as it will be used here, it's more as a belief or trust in God. Religion, the term derives from the Latin religare, to bind together. And so what religion really is, as opposed to faith, is a system of beliefs and practices that people follow. I know that's all very obvious to you, but I think it's important to separate that religion and faith and belief from religiosity, which is the degree of participation in the beliefs and practices of an organized religion. So it's a way of getting a handle on somebody's. It's very hard to quantify if somebody says, I'm Catholic, or I'm Lutheran, or I'm Jewish, what does that mean? And they say, well, I'm a strong that, or I really believe that, or I have faith in that. And then you're going to try to compare that to someone who says, well, I'm sort of a Catholic or whatever. So one way to look at it is to see what their participation is. Do they go to church every week? So is it a high degree of participation in those religious activities, or is it a low? And then we kind of can compare those kinds of things with outcomes. Now, spirituality is something very different. It derives from the Greek, meaning breath. It really was the essence of life. It was the essence of the individual. And it's described here as the quality of holding a philosophy, doctrine, or religion that emphasizes that vital spirit. So it's a little bit different from faith in something. It's more internal, and it's more spiritual rather than material. And another way of looking at it is to define it as a broad, dynamic concept that involves both meaning and purpose, looking at more than existence, more than just the material part of life, but also encompassing values of compassion, justice, and love, and things of that sort. So spirituality, much broader, much more intrinsic than religion or faith, but also, as you can tell, it's very hard to get a handle on that. For a scientist to look at that and say, well, you know, who's spiritual, who isn't, and how do you grade that? It's almost impossible. So we've got just a couple pictures here. Spirituality much broader than just the religious aspect. Religion certainly can be involved in that, and belief in God, but so can the appreciation of beauty or music or the arts or aesthetic. Yes, Kate?
Cliff, I just was wanting to ask if everybody could hear you in the back of the room.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody that can hear me?
Okay. Good.
Very good. So Jim was here a while ago. He's going to come in a little bit later. He spent some time in Botswana. The picture at the bottom is Botswana at sunset, and what you see in the water there are the eyes of the nostrils of a hippopotamus kind of looking back at me. Mm-hmm. That's Victoria Falls on the right. And the cathedral in Italy on the left. So spirituality can be a much broader. And what more spiritual place than Holden Village? It's also a religious place. So, I mean, and where there's the blending of that in this community. And there's my colors again. So this is the many-colored grace of God, and so that we have some colors in there. So religiosity, which again is the degree of participation in behaviors of a religion, spirituality, health status. Just as a way to go back for a second from yesterday's discussion, when we talked about the determinants of health, and we showed that the healthcare services. Health of individuals and health of a society. Whereas the larger component of that is the social, economic, cultural, and behavioral parts. And those two are really hooked together. We talked about that a little bit, that you find that people that are in the higher social, economic groups are much less likely to be obese, much less likely to be sedentary, much less likely to be smokers. There's a lot of factors that go in that. And part of that cultural, you can see maybe how religion might work into that, or religiosity might work into that in some way. We talked a little bit about metaphors yesterday, about a metaphor. So here's a metaphor that I'd like you to sort of think about for a minute, about religion and health and the connection of the two. Historically, the medicine man, the shaman, was not only the religious person in the tribe or the community, but it was also the physician. And the questions that were asked by an individual who was suffering in some way, either from a physical or mental or emotional or spiritual disorder, to improve that outcome. How can we do it? So how do we explain the present? How do we predict the future? And how can we create a better future? And that's really what both the priest and the physician, and back then it was really a single person. So I'd like to just extend that to the medical center of today and compare that. Just think of the temple. Think of a Mayan temple. Come into, if you can picture coming into a mining community, it'd be the pyramid, the Great Temple. It was the town's dominant architecture. You come into Corvallis, Oregon, and you come in from the north on Highway 99. This building kind of dominates the skyline. It's up on a hill. That's the medical center where I work. Not exactly in the shape of a pyramid, but nonetheless a dominant architect. The priests, the physicians, are they similar in some way? Building, that's there was a sanctuary where only the priests could go. There's operating rooms where only the surgeons can go. The priests wore special robes and garments. Surgeons wear their specific gowns and masks. There they are. And the sacrifices where they operate. They sacrificed somebody to find out what was going to happen. We offer. This is purely just, it just happened the way it is. Is there something in the culture that almost wants us to recreate that kind of historical thing? I just throw that out because I sort of like metaphors and like to think how people. Also, the role of the priest in the temple was to explain, predict, and influence the course of events. The physician diagnoses, comes up with a prognosis. Relationship between medicine and religion and faith for many decades and hundreds and even a few thousand years. Okay, so let's look at the beneficial effects of participating in religious activity. So we can't quantify spirituality and faith, as we said. So we don't really look at that. So the studies that are out there, and there are numerous studies, associate the degree of religious activity to health outcomes. And the studies are usually observational, epidemiological, and prospective. They're not really controlled because we really can't control for somebody's religious behavior. I mean, we could try. We could take people and say, now you go to church and you don't go to church, and then see who does better over a period of time. That's not going to work because there's too many factors that go into why someone chooses to go to church. So there are no real control studies, and there's very little. We'll have something to say about the religion or the religious beliefs of the physician. All right, mortality. So a whole series of studies have been done based looking at mortality data, looking at cardiovascular disease, hypertension. I'll just read a couple studies for you. With respect to mortality, there have been maybe 40 or 50 studies. Almost all of them have demonstrated that if you attend religious services on a regular basis, that group of people lives longer than those people who don't attend on a regular basis. One study took place over 28 years. They studied 5,286 adults aged between 21 and 65, and they found that those that attended once a week or more, compared to those that were less than that, they had a 23% less likely chance of dying during that period, that 28-year period. Another study looked at 1,900 adults who were over 55. There was a 24% reduction in mortality amongst those that went to church on a regular basis. A study out of New Haven looking at 2,800 older adults found that frequent religious attenders in 1982 were significantly less likely than infrequent attenders to be physically disabled at 12 years into the study. So physical disability, mortality, cardiovascular disease, right across the board do we see a reduction in morbidity and mortality in regular religious, people who take part in regular religious activity. A study out of Israel looking at secular Jewish versus Orthodox Jewish found that the risk of myocardial infarction, heart attack, in the secular group was 4 times higher in men and 7 times higher in women than in the Orthodox group. A study of 10,000 Israeli civil servants comparing Orthodox to the non-religious men, there was a 20% reduction in coronary artery disease. 14 out of 16 studies that I found, looking at blood pressure, found that blood pressure was lower in those that attended church on a regular basis. And they tended to be more accepting of end-of-life issues. Depression, less common in regular churchgoers. Same is true to a certain extent for anxiety, especially in younger individuals. People over 65, there doesn't seem to be much difference with respect to anxiety, whether you go to church or don't go to church. I can't explain why that is. With respect to suicide, there's an inverse relationship between belief in God and attendance at religious services. Attending religious services correlates with good health outcomes. And so is that just an association, or is that really the cause? And that's really the question that that we try to come up with. But religiosity is associated with a bunch of other things. So when you sort of delve into this a little bit more deeply and say, okay, well, what people who attend they tend to follow diets a little bit better. Seatbelt use, isn't that an interesting thing? That if you go to church regularly, you're more likely to hook your seatbelt. And it's just maybe a behavioral thing, is that you tend to obey. Somebody tells you to go to church every weekend, you do it. They tell you to hook the seatbelt, you do it. They tell you to stop smoking, you do it. They tell you to stop, if you're just a good person, you know, your mother and father will be very proud of you. And you'll live longer. And so right down the list, there's a whole bunch of things, but you also know that all those things contribute to better health, better outcomes, less disease, less morbidity. So is it the religion part of it, or is there something that's different about these people? And if it could be, you know, how does this happen? Is it just the healthy habits and obedience, or is it the social support you get in there? I mean, we know that that's an important part. We said early on that one of the major determinants of longevity and health is what kind of social economic condition you find yourself in and what kind of social support you have. Positive emotions, the relaxation response, which has been studied, that one of the best ways to achieve, the relaxation response is something that anybody can get, almost put themselves into a trance by getting in a quiet, peaceful place and repeating something that doesn't happen. And it's been studied, this fellow by the name of Herbert Benson at Harvard has really has got a lot of fame and attention out of that. Lowers your blood pressure, lowers your heart rate. It's one that participates in that kind of activity can do some things that are obviously very important. So it reduces the stress response. The immunological response of individuals is improved following practice those kinds of practices. So yoga, praying, relaxation response all do positive things for the body and may be part of the beneficial mediator. Okay, so what conclusions can we draw from the kinds of studies we were just talking about from a medical point of view? What your physicians might be thinking of? Religious activities are associated with better health outcomes, but church attendance is self-reported, so we can't prove that they were at church and say they were. No, not everybody. Don pointed out yesterday that my patients lie to me. You know, they just quit smoking and they haven't, or they really only had one beer at Don's lecture. Of course, he kept track of how many beers. We know who did.
There's a couple of bottles missing.
Do they exercise? Do they do some of these other things? Most patients believe that religious activity and prayer improves their health and speech recovery, and that may in itself be of importance. And whether or not religion is truly causative, it's certainly possible. You can certainly follow Christian optimistic outlook without holding religious beliefs. So someone without religious beliefs can certainly achieve that kind of lifestyle that may would have those beneficial effects and not necessarily have to go to church. Okay, here's a question. Is your doctor religious and do you care? The medical community has been very, as you can imagine. So no studies have compared patient outcomes according to religious practices. So if you're going to go in for open heart surgery, you know, do you ask your physician, are you a God-fearing, religious man who goes to church every Sunday, or are you out playing golf all the time, fishing, or are you the kind of surgeon who's practicing tying knots at home and reading the textbooks? You know, what kind of surgeon do you really want to be taking care of you? So are you better off with a religious doctor? I can't answer that question. I won't. But what if your doctor is a fundamentalist of a religion that's different than yours and believes very, very strongly? He's already convinced you're going to hell anyway. let's be honest here. You know, I mean, is that do you want to know that?
You mean you may want to speed you up on your...
These are questions that maybe we don't really want to address, or maybe we do want to address. There was an article in Friday's Wall Street Journal that talked about foreign medical graduates in Iowa. Did anybody see that? They don't know how to talk to the Iowa farmer.
We're from Iowa.
You're from Iowa. They don't know how to talk to guys like you.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and they did not really talk about religion, but there were people from India and Pakistan and did some. Exactly how all this plays out, they're actually trying to teach physicians
how small talk.
The small talk that kind of helps every relationship. Okay, there's some beneficial effects that go beyond the individual. So we've been talking about the individual. Now, what about society? So there's faith-based social nets that are out there, safety nets. The Episcopal Church actually saved the hospital from bankruptcy back in the early 1940s when it was in some severe financial problem. And certainly, the Providence Health System in Portland is well known as Sisters of Providence, run many hospitals and church hospitals and schools, colleges. We know that education is an important part of health, and certainly to the extent that there's so many colleges and schools supported by religious organizations. Missionary schools and hospitals, and I worked at a missionary hospital run by Lutherans in Liberia back 40 years ago. Prison-based missionary work has been very effective in improving the health of prisoners, and faith-based support groups for substance abuse, physical and sexual abuse, and things of that sort. And certainly, religions and religious thought has contributed significantly to the understanding of medical ethics. So there are some very positive beneficial effects on a global scale. Conclusions again, there appears to be good evidence of an association between religious observance and improved health of individual practitioners and groups of those practitioners. Are there any negative effects of on health of religion? Anybody want to either say yes or no? Gazette, our local newspaper in Corvallis, there was a whole series of cases that have recently come up in Oregon of a faith healing sect around Oregon City where a couple of kids died. Another little girl was allowed to have this mass on that just got progressively larger and lost her vision in her eye because the family was just praying for her and did not take her. I mean, this was a benign growth that led to blindness in his eye and severe disfiguration of this girl. People gotten jail sentences out of this. Parents have gotten jail sentences out of this because the state has felt there's been responsibility for the well-being of children. So avoidance of necessary care under circumstances.
This is because they've done something bad and that God is punishing them. I have seen that. It is real. It is, people suffer with that. Conflict with care providers. We sort of made light of it maybe about a fundamentalist thing, but there really are potential problems. There certainly are problems when care providers will not provide care that's legally available and medically indicated. Significant problem in this country, in my opinion, and whether that relates to birth control or what is most troublesome is a physician or a practitioner or a pharmacist who will not give the options to someone, who will just say, no, that's not available, you can't have it. And in a small rural town where there are no other options to get something, then it becomes very difficult. The condoms to prevent AIDS, you may be very well aware of what the Catholic Church did in Africa in the all through the 90s and the early 21st century in terms of putting up billboards and posters and putting out information that stating absolutely incorrectly that condoms did not prevent the spread of the AIDS virus, because the church did not want anyone to use condoms for birth control. And that, I mean, one has to look at that. Now, that sentenced probably tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of sub-Saharan Africans, or contributed to their development of AIDS that they wouldn't otherwise have. So are there negative effects? Yeah, I think one has to. In Oregon and in Washington, both states have legal physician-assisted suicide or physician aid in dying, as we call it. And that's despite huge efforts on the part of the Catholic Church to defeat those initiatives. But they were passed by the majority of citizens in both states. All right. So still get sick. And from a population perspective, many countries with low levels of religiosity, there are many countries where not many people go to church, they have better life expectancy and health outcomes than in the U.S., which has a higher level of religious activity. So now we got a paradox here, and maybe it helps individuals. What does it do for on a national scale? So this marked variability of religious beliefs across nations. And we'll look at some of the data that might surprise some of us. Many nations are overwhelmingly atheistic. And we're not necessarily, and I really don't want to talk about coercive atheism any more than I want to talk about coercive religious beliefs. So if you're in Saudi Arabia, you pretty much ought to be follow Islam. If you're in North Korea or China, there's a lot of persecution of almost any religious faith. The official position of the state is atheism. Yes.
For health is social interaction. In the United States, because of the way our culture has developed, old people, the main place they have for social interaction is the church. Whereas in many of these other countries, culturally, old people are still very much valued and, you know, kept within the social circle.
An excellent point. So when we kind of look at some of these countries, we're going to look at not at coercive atheism, but what's been referred to in the literature as organic atheism, which is an open democratic where people have a choice of whether to believe or whether to be involved in religious activities or not. And of all the industrialized countries, the United States is by far the most religious, or at least is reportedly as the most religious. So let's look at the race of non-believers. These would be people who characterize themselves as either atheist or agnostic. And data, and it's all based on adults, not on children. These are people over 21 who presumably have the choice. And so that kind of gives you, you know, from Japan, the Scandinavian countries especially, but even France, which you sort of think of as a Catholic country, you know, approximately 50% of the individuals consider themselves either agnostic or atheist. In the United States, the latest data from a Pew poll demonstrated 4 to 5% of adult Americans identify as atheists. Another 6 to 8% identify themselves as agnostic. And then there's a significant group of people who believe in a supreme being of some kind, but don't consider themselves as part of any specific religion. And so that's if you say if you take that combination there, it's somewhere in the 6 to 12% range as compared to 65% in Japan. So if we look at those, we now this is the data from yesterday. We looked at infant mortality, and you look at those countries, and you say, "Oh my goodness, there's a relation. I mean, there's an association on infant mortality." You look at this disability-adjusted life expectancy that we talked about. This is how many years can you expect to live with before you become significantly disabled? And again, there appears to be some kind of relationship to non-belief. Newsweek's list of the best healthcare systems. Again, look at that rates of non-believers, and then you look at the disability adjusted. I mean, it's very similar. There's the United States down there at the bottom. We're high believers but have poor outcomes. And so that's sort of a paradox. And it's also some other things that highly religious nations, when we look at societal health, infant mortality, poverty, homicides, literacy, only in rates of suicide does the United States really show up. Almost surprising. That's another surprising thing. One would think if you're really religious and you thought you were going to go to heaven or life after, maybe you would be in a hurry to go there. Guess not.
So there's a real strong religious feeling of suicide. Yeah, that suicide
is against. Yes, absolutely. An absolute point, and I don't mean to make light of that. So there seems to be there's an inverse relationship between religiosity of a population and health fund. And that less religious countries tend to have longer life expectancy, lower infant mortality, longer disability-adjusted life expectancy, and have higher rankings of the healthcare system. Now, is that, you know, the real question is that an association or is that in any way a causation? And I don't think we have any evidence to say that it's really causation. Kind of the exception in that it may be our individualistic attitude towards so many things. Opportunity in the United States seems, I mean, you had to pick a word. What are you going to describe our culture as and what do we really value? We probably value opportunity more than community. And I suspect we have folks here that grew up in Denmark that would not say that would be the way those things would be reversed in Denmark, that community is more important than opportunity. Whereas the United States, so it'd be an individual opportunity. It takes precedence over a sense of community. I don't know if that's true. Would you comment on that? You think that's true?
I would suggest that because some of the Scandinavian countries have a more inclusive healthcare system that provides for longer life in general, even though they may not be believers in any religion.
Or maybe some of the social that social community, that social interaction, maybe families stay together longer or have more ties that, that are the social economic, and they have less of the economic variability between the extreme extremes of poverty and wealth, which you don't see in the Scandinavian countries like you see in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's the key. I think that the disparity between the wealthy and the poor is so much greater in the United States than it is any place else in the world, that that accounts for a whole lot of this difference we see in infant mortality and in some of these other factors that we're talking about.
Can you take it to the next step and explain why a country
I think that there is a basic belief in capitalism and picking yourself up with bootstraps, and that plays well in a lot of ways, except a lot of us don't think about the externalities of the marketplace, and also we don't necessarily think about the prejudice that has existed in this country and the lack of opportunity for some segments, large segments of the country, to pick themselves up. And I think that plays a role also.
I think we're more of a melting pot, too, of a lot of different cultures.
Right.
Whereas some of these other countries you're comparing to are much more homogeneous.
And that's changing.
Yeah.
I heard you say that we like to think of ourselves now as a salad bowl.
Right.
As opposed to a melting pot.
Okay.
That we are now Native American, or we're now Hispanic, or we're now that kind of a thing. But there are some huge disparities in the income of these various groups.
Right.
That's kind of what I was going to ask, if you thought that if you took all these statistics and separated them by economic status, would they, in other words, in the countries where there's more wealthy people, would they fare better, or I'm just throwing that out?
Yeah, I haven't looked
economic
at that.
Economic status, essentially.
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's no question that if you're higher on the social economic ladder, you're going to have better health. So whether you're religious or not religious, that's probably going to overwhelm almost anything else. Yes?
And I think it's also a matter of economics and taxation. In the Scandinavian countries, the taxes are extremely high, and that goes to the social services that people get there. I'm not at all sure, though, that the disparity between the rich and poor is greater here than in places like India.
Oh, it's not. We're really only been looking at developed countries to compare here.
There's a question right here.
Observation in terms of, this is the first time I've seen, you know, we're talking about 70% of our country claims to be religious. How much of that religiosity is engrossed in conflict? In other words, most of your other developed countries are state churches, where it's basically an understanding of what the religious life is for that country. Here it's been based on all individualism and a sense of being against. You know, I serve in an area of the country where you've got, as my son-in-law says, if you put a sign on the barn door that a Baptist church is starting, people just flock to it because they're exiting from other churches in which they've had a problem. So, and we all are a part of that in terms of our Lutheran roots. If our religious association with church ends up where somewhere along the line you go through a deep schism, to me, that's not healthy.
Yeah, that's that religious struggle we referred to before. That's a good point. And I'm not pretending that any of this is answered. What I'm throwing out is a bunch of data that are out there, and I think we should be aware of, and then try to fit that into our own perceptions and our own beliefs and our own political processes as we kind of maybe try to address some of those issues and understand them a little bit better. Okay, do the postulated beneficial effects outweigh the known negative effects? I don't have an answer for that. Before we go to intercessory prayer and sort of talk about that, any other comments or thoughts about what I've presented here today, which is has no answers. There are various kinds of associations you can throw out and look at and try to think about it and try to explain. Yeah.
Talked to colleagues, pastors that have been worried about the statistics regarding clergy health. Are there any studies that talk about studying clergy communities, monastic communities, otherwise, as opposed to whole populations, in terms of?
I don't. I have some data from the 1850s. It's a little old, but I will quote tomorrow. You know, and what they pointed out, because it was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association about the life expectancies of physicians, clergy, and judges, who were the three great professions back in the mid 1800s, on who lived the longest and everything. And so I have that, and the answer was the judges lived the longest. The doctors lived the least long, but they were dying back in those days. They died of tuberculosis because it was a occupational disease. And it was very common. They took care of people with consumption, and they ended up with it themselves. You know, the old holiday picture.
Right. Right.
But the only religious community data that I am aware of is the nun study. Are you familiar with that? I will actually show. I have a copy of the book. It's a great study about Catholic nuns in convents, and how healthy they are, and how well they have aged. And it was a study to look at why some got Alzheimer's disease and some didn't, and how they really aged in a very healthy fashion. We'll be able to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. Yes?
I think your idea of pointing out the temple of the modern America is the hospital. I think that's very accurate. I like that. And I think it's interesting that in a society like ours where that's the case, we have among sort of the lower quality of healthcare. And one just wondering what that's about. And also wondering about the power of the market in our healthcare versus the power of the market in European or Japanese healthcare, where there's such a profit motive in our healthcare as opposed to.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one of the things we hammered away at yesterday was in designing the system. I mean, virtually every developed country has taken out the profit.
Right.
Except the United States has kept it in. And the Obamacare has not taken it out at all. I mean, and so you know, the idea that we can have a presidential candidate say that this was a government takeover of the healthcare industry is so ludicrous that I think it immediately disqualifies her from any consideration. So I won't point out who it was. And now I'm talking about religion and politics. And I am getting into deep trouble. Now Don will save me by passing out some licorice.
I can do that. And personal health benefits.
Yes. There's an association, let me put it that way. So that, yes, there's a correlation, but that doesn't prove causation.
So then my follow-up question is, what time's the Vespers?
7:30 and you be there. All right, let's move on. The comment was, what time is Vespers tonight? So intercessory prayer. This is interesting. So what is prayer? I mean, you know, here's a doctor telling a group at Holden what prayer is. It's a petition to God or some other deity, and one can ask. And it's two different kinds of prayers. One is intercessory. The other is the first definition. There is to ask for strength or equanimity in the face of adversity. Now that's a very personal thing. You're looking for strength, like, you know. Or, God, cure me, or God, have the surgeon cure me, or God, take away my disease, or whatever. That's a very different kind of prayer, obviously. So an intercessory prayer is asking God to intercede. So a way of looking at it, you can ask God to intercede on our own behalf, cure me. While the child or the wife is there, you can do it right in the presence of that person so they know you're praying for. Where that person doesn't know you're praying for them. So you're praying for somebody at a distance or somebody that the person may be sitting next to you at Vespers and you may be saying a prayer asking God to intervene on their behalf to cure them or help them or give them strength. And so that's intercessory prayer. So here's an interesting survey that was done in 2008 by the American Medical Association, done in the United States. And if the doctors treating your family member said, futility has been reached. You know, Uncle Joe here on the hooked up to life support. There's nothing else we can do. He has severe brain damage. His organs are all failing. There's nothing else we can do. Would you believe that divine intervention by God could save that person? How many here think God could intervene or might or could?
Could.
Okay. Good. So let's see what the general population in the United States says. Divine intervention by God. 57% of the population in the United States said yes. If you went to the medical professionals, they interviewed the nurses, the intensive care unit nurses, and physicians. It was 20%. But still 20%, even though the physicians were saying, you know, this is reached the end of the road here. Not the other thing, we should discontinue life support at this point. We've reached what we term medical futility. And close you are to death, you say, you know, are you absolutely certain, doctor, there's not a one in a billion chance that this person can make it? You know, there's always some kind of, that something happens that you don't expect, but I thought that was a little bit surprising on the professional part. I'm not surprised as far as the public. So intercessory prayer, again, historical relationship between religion, the priest is a healer, miracles, we've been hearing about miracles forever and ever. A true miracle, the plane crashed and 11 people survived, that was a miracle. I mean, that's what the newspaper might say. Well, that's not what a miracle is. A miracle isn't just a rare event. A miracle is something that violates the laws of nature. So Don, you know, has this big, heavy rock, and he says, it's going to rise, and he lets it go, and it goes floating up into the air. That's a miracle. I mean, that shouldn't happen. but Don might be able to pull that off someday. So intercessory prayer. So this would be, you know, so Sir Francis Galton, who was a cousin of Charles Darwin, lived about the same time. He said, "Boy, if there's ever going to be a chance that prayer is going to help somebody, it's going to help the royal family." Because everybody is God save the queen, God save the queen. You know, everybody's praying for the queen or the king or the princess. So he went in to looked at the life expectancies of the royal family, and they were actually shorter than the average life expectancy back at that time. So he published this as some articles and saying, you know, that the intercessory prayer obviously doesn't work. He also decided that another way to look at it was to look at slave ships and missionary ships sailing the oceans, thinking that, you know, which ship is more likely to run into a storm and sink? The missionary ship filled with missionaries praying like crazy, or the slave ships, you know, where everybody's despairing and the slave masters are cracking whips and got people chained. And so he went to the records of Lloyd's of London, because he figured Lloyd's of London would have the data, and because they insured these ships. And certainly if the missionary ships were safer, they would have lower rates than the slave ships. And it turned out the rates were the same. So he concluded that all the praying on the missionary ships didn't have didn't really do very much good. Florence Nightingale felt that even when people were dying and unconscious, that a word of prayer reached them, and I think that's true too. I think there is something that even though we think they're unresponsive, they sometimes recognize what's going on around
when
them.
When you say reach them, you mean reaches them and maybe.
Because I don't know, I don't believe in extrasensory stuff, I do believe that people we think are not responsive to anything do, well, you know, if I start saying that they do sense that somebody is there, then maybe that is extrasensory.
In nursing, they say that hearing is one of the last senses to go.
Well, that would not be extrasensory, though.
It
may be more of that and other kinds of ways that people can sense each other. But whether it's true, I don't believe that it's something that's not in the physical world. You know, but we're this huge amount of electrical activity going on in us. You know, whether we're little radio transmitters, very low intensity just because of the electrical activity. Anyway, just to look at a couple things of intercessory prayer, a study in 1965 of psychiatric and rheumatic disease patients, volunteers prayed for them. In that particular study, it made no difference. Randolph Bird at my old institution, San Francisco General Hospital in San Francisco, he got a bunch of born-again Christians to pray. And prayed over people that were on life support in the intensive care unit, the coronary care unit at San Francisco General Hospital. And he found that the people who were prayed for needed lower doses of antibiotics and had less days on life support, but there was no difference in the outcome. So at the end of a month, there was no difference in mortality. And half of them got prayed for, and half of them didn't get prayed for, and there was no difference in outcomes. But so John Jones, you get five more people to pray for him, but this guy's got 100 friends back in his parish, and they're all praying like crazy. You know, so what is this five? You know, is the five going to outweigh the 100 that are praying for him, or you know? You obviously get into a lot of problems when you're trying to do it. A test like that. There was a similar study done in 2001 in Israel looking at 3,000 patients. They had people pray for them, and the prayer group had slightly decreased hospital stays and a little bit less fever, but again, no difference in overall mortality. The study that was going to solve this issue forever and ever was Herbert Benson. I referred to him earlier as the guru who worked with the relaxation response and the brain waves. And John Templeton, the old Sir John Templeton, very religious man, one of the world's richest men, funded this, put up millions of dollars to fund this because he believed very strongly that prayer would have an influence. 1,800 patients undergoing bypass surgery. 6 U.S. hospitals, including hospitals at Harvard Medical School, Yale, and a number of other well-reputable places. They divided those 1,800 patients into 3 groups, and you see each one was about 600. Some received prayer, and they were told, you might be getting prayed for. Another 600, they were told, you might be prayed for, but they weren't prayed for. There were 600 that were told, we are going to pray for you. And they did pray for them. So now you got 3 groups. You have 1 group that knows they're going to be prayed for. You got 2 groups that maybe I'm going to be prayed for, maybe not. But half of them are being prayed for, half of them not being prayed for. And they prayed for 14 days, and they had, I forgot how many people they had. They had like 10 or 12 or 15 people praying. And it was a big study. They got a lot of people praying. For these folks. So what did they find? This was published in 2005. This was a big study, and it cost Templeton millions of dollars to do the study. Okay, of the two groups that didn't know whether they were really getting prayed for, so 600 got prayed for, 600 didn't get prayed for, the complications from the surgery, 52% versus 51%. No difference. Statistically, essentially exactly the same. So there was no difference, had no impact. But in the group of people that were told they were going to be prayed for and were prayed for, they had complications in 59%, which was statistically significant. So, you know, you can say, well, 59 versus 52, that's no difference. But actually, there were enough patients that it actually was statistically significant. And so what do you conclude from, or what can you conclude from the fact that these people were prayed for, but they had a higher rate? The problem seemed to be that they knew they were going to be prayed for. And so when you tell somebody, we're going to pray for you, we're doing this study, and you're in the group we're going to definitely pray for, that the first thing you think, they must think
I'm in trouble.
I'm in trouble. They wouldn't be praying for me if they didn't know. They know something they haven't told me, you know, that my heart is worse than all these other people. And probably, I mean, that was the conclusion that the researchers ultimately drew. Whether that's the right conclusion or not, we don't. Evidence that proves that intercessory prayer is helpful. Yes?
So all those books that Dr. Larry Dossey wrote in the last 10 years, giving hundreds of studies, have been discredited?
Yes.
Wow.
None of that was controlled studies. And so in the medical world, I mean, there's all kinds of anecdotal studies for all kinds of stuff out there. You get on the internet and you can find, you know, onions will cure your coronary artery. That somebody got better after they did something, or somebody that we were sure was going to die got better when somebody did something, or some group of people did. But when the only thing that you can accept, and we talked about this yesterday, about evidence-based scientific medicine, before we say this definitely works, I'm not saying don't do this or don't eat bananas or don't pray. All I'm saying is that we don't have any scientific evidence that proves that it's effective. Doesn't mean it's not effective, it just means we have no scientific evidence to prove that it's effective.
Yeah, I guess his conclusion was that there will be a time when doctors will be sued for malpractice if they don't pray with you.
Well, that's it. That comes down to it. I mean, you really get it. I mean, if you want to go, you want somebody to pray with you, go to your priest or your minister or your advisor or your good friends in your congregation. If you want somebody to operate on you and do a good job, go to your doctor. Don't or in historic times, as we talked right at the very beginning. Okay, so here's more questions than answers. And so this actually addresses just what you were mentioning. Do we really want to deal with religion and spirituality as just another method of treating illness? And your comment about, is a doctor going to be sued because he doesn't pray with his patient or he doesn't somehow identify that? I hope we don't go in that direction. And I hope we never become so coercive, either in terms of coercive atheism like in China or coercive religion like in Saudi Arabia, that we just don't ever, that we maintain that freedom. And I think we should fight for that. Is prayer outside the scope of scientific inquiry? My one quote from the Bible, you shall not test the Lord thy God. And is that just what we're doing when we set up these scientific studies to test the Lord? I mean, what are we doing? I mean, you know, is this, do we really want to do that? And do we really want our physicians to advise? Is that what you want your doctor to say to you? Or do you want him to stop when he gets to losing weight? Or say something like, look at ways of social involvement, volunteerism, keep having involvement with life and with the community and with people that you share like, and get to know people that you don't share every opinion with. Or do you want your doctor to say, take two aspirins, say a prayer, and call me in the morning? And that may be better than sometimes showing up in the emergency room. So. And isn't religion really just another dimension of human life? which may or may not have health benefits, and do we really care whether it's health benefits, or should we care, or is it such an important part of life that whether, if there's some health benefits, that's great, and if there's not the goal in itself. Health is the means. Healthcare helps us get health, but it's only a little piece of that, and health helps us live a full life. So what we really want is that full life, and that includes emotional, spiritual, physical health, and not just that one element of physical health. And then what role should physicians play in our spiritual life? Should they be aware of our belief system? Is that important? Should they pray with us? Do you want them to advise us about religion, or do you really want them to stick to the scientific important part of that? And for some people, I'm sure it is, and for others, it isn't. And the problem will be trying to, with physician shortages and with increasing diversity of our population, and an inevitable movement toward, you know, I think we will become more like Western Europe and more like Scandinavia in the next 30, 40 years, so that we're going to have there are going to be more non-believers in this country, and that means more and when you look at non-believers and you look at education, it turns out that if you look at PhDs, they're disproportionately atheistic or non-believers, and so and MDs are probably somewhere intermediate in that. So you're going to have more non-believers, and if, is that going to interfere with one's relationship with their physicians? And I would hope that it would not interfere, and that we separate those things. So this, for those who believe in God, no explanation is necessary. For those who don't believe in God, you could explain that relationship. And my last slide here, the priest and the physician are no longer one and the same as they were in biblical times. The services which each provides should complement and supplement each other for the benefit of the patient and the patient's physical and mental well-being during life and at the end of life. And I thank you very much.
Thank you.